And of course, once again, the opening, please follow Lior Stravinsky's new Sackhawk Q-Clan song, The Rhinos. He was inspired by the nationalistic impulses of Russian composers, principally his mentor, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, who was very interested in the collection of folk melodies and their incorporation into compositions to mark those compositions as Russian. In this, he was a second stage nationalist, for those melodies in Rimsky-Korsakov's treatment ornamented a fundamentally Central European style, dramatic style. Rimsky-Korsakov died in 1907. Stravinsky's next stage of his career came about quite by accident when he began to collaborate with several other Russian artists in a series of compositions that were to be ballets for Paris. The connection between St. Petersburg and Paris, and indeed Russia, particularly the upper class nobility of Russia and Paris, had historically been a post. You might wonder, well, why do Russians leap all the way over Poland and Germany to find that cultural allies and sympathy in France? So it goes back to the period of the late 18th century, when French, as well as Italian, composers and artists reigned in the Russian court for the Tsars. And not even Napoleon's invasion of Russia caused an end to that cultural relationship. Stravinsky's three major ballets were composed for Paris. And you can see that they appeared over the course of 4 years, 3 years, I should say, beginning with the Firebird, Ludovico, 1910, Petrushka, and then the Rite of Spring in 1913. Now, as I said last time, and I will demonstrate, Stravinsky, in order to capture the attention of the Parisians, highly sophisticated audience of musicians, essentially capitalized upon his knowledge of clubbing seasons and drew upon textures and drew upon a lot of material that Debussy had, in a sense, laid out in some of his more influential works in the 1890s. Going back to that year or so. Among the works that he also composed, that is, Stravinsky composed in this period, or at least began in this period, was a short opera based upon a folk tale that the Danish folklorist Hans Christian Andersen had collected. In French, known as Le Rossignol, in English as The Nightingale. It is here where we can see unmistakable evidence of Debussy's role in shaping Stravinsky's style in the period at the beginning of his Paris connection. Let's begin by listening to, of course, a work that is by now well known to you, Nuage, the first of the orchestral character pieces, known as the Nocturne. Is this in parts? No. You'll remember, it goes like this. That is the opening from a fire. The first first of his ballets. What do they have in common? Well, Debussy's melody descends and ascends, and in so doing, outlines a truncheon. Stravinsky's melody, though with fewer pitches, has the identical contour. It outlines the same unit. Tritone, descending, ascending. So Stravinsky is, again, even in these works, fulfilling Temperley's description of a second stage nationalism. The subject matter of the Firebird, the subject matter of Petrushka, are both Russian folk tales or images of Russian country peasant life. But he is using elements from the alien culture. Remember how Temperley describes it? Let's look at that text again. That aspect of second stage nationalism. Here somewhere. Let's see it somewhere. Well, it's me, but I can take that away from me. I stand for it. Remember second stage. Native subject. The native subject matter constitutes the basis for the narrative behind these two ballets. Russian, both theories. Now, the style is still fundamentally that of the foreign culture. In this case, it's Debussy. It is the French late 19th century style. Now, no native tunes here. That's one thing that's different. But Russian folk subject matter, French stylistic elements. This is what defines Stravinsky's style in his ballet. Is there a question about that? Now, we come, of course, to the major work, The Rite of Spring, which is itself a form of nationalistic expression, though admittedly not one that fits comfortably into the Temperley model. It is the most celebrated of Stravinsky's early pieces. It is the piece that everybody misunderstands in terms of its impact upon its first audience, its opening night audience, because it was very important to Igor Stravinsky that people believed what scholars think is decidedly uncertain, that it's his music that prompted the riot in the Paris venue the night of his first performance. Stravinsky, of course, wanted to dine out on being the one who caused all that disruption. And in his ghost-written autobiography, but no as told to in the title page, he talks about what he was trying to do to maintain order as the audience was rioting, hissing, booing, beating up one another, depending on which side of the taste line they sat or stood. But in truth, there's every reason to believe that far more, in a sense, offensive to Paris taste than the music was the ballet itself, the choreography, the costumes, the actual display of dancing was far more violative of Parisian standards than was the music. But Stravinsky was perfectly happy to claim credit for this. What is this about, the Rite of Spring? What are we talking about here? We are talking about Stravinsky's alleged dream one night, in which he envisioned a pre-Christian Russian community. This would take us back, presumably, into the before the Common Era, before sometime Neolithic, very ostensibly primitive in the sense that very first civilization. And what was supposed to happen was spring was coming, and supposedly humanity at the time did not understand that spring came as a function of the orbit of the planet, the tilt of the Earth, its relationship to the Sun. No, spring would only come if a virgin was sacrificed. One has to speculate idly at different times about what's with this virgin today. Why the obsession with virgins? But anyway. And so this ballet purports to replicate this event, at the end of which, at the climax of which, the selected virgin dances herself to death. This particular scenario was acted out, was realized by a choreographer and dancer named Nijinsky, with reportedly all sorts of crude and clumsy motions by the dancers. Not the grace and elegance that we associate with Russian national ballet, the ballets for which Tchaikovsky wrote scores, such as Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, but rough and crude actions and motions. Because, of course, everybody knows, while we walk with enormous grace and dignity, I mean, I'm sure you've all commented upon the grace that I bring to my motions in one another. Our ancestors allegedly stumbled around, bent over, stomping on the earth with their bare feet, because they were primitive. When you're primitive, you do that sort of thing. Never mind, of course, when the subject was supposed to come. Analysis, when we think of our, the other inhabitants of the planet who have, let's say, four paws on the ground, or hooves on the ground, and who move with incredible grace, somehow with 2 feet, we didn't do it when we were first on the planet. In other words, don't subject this to any close analysis, because the whole concept just falls apart. Nevertheless, the light of spring represented for Stravinsky a major turning point. It made him an international subject of attention. It established in people's minds that Stravinsky was part of the cutting edge of Western musical thought. And indeed, in many of the characteristics of the piece, we find a complexity of rhythm unseen before in European art. And everybody was dumbfounded by the complexities of the cross rhythms and so forth, which they had never encountered before in such a tradition. Mind you, that West Africans, had they encountered this music, would probably have regarded it as, well, a good try at some rhythmic complexity, but those of you who look at the score, and indeed you have a score, and have served in the White Spring, in your anthologies, as part of your listening, will surely have observed their bar lines regularly, right? They're regular downbeats. There's nothing contradictory. This is not polyrhythm. This is not polyrhythm. Nothing like that. But nevertheless, at the time, and with the instrumentation, the character of the music galvanized the attention of many. Thank you. thing that is so good on this, well, sorry, this is Tony Newton. The drama of the Rhythms and the Crossroads distracts from that. And the Crossroads themselves are meant to suggest a certain set of dance steps, again suggestive of this allegedly clumsy character of our ancestors. But indeed, this work marked the ending of post-romanticism, as far as Stravinsky was concerned, coming as it did in 1913, just before the beginning of World War I, which, as many of you have commented, marked the end of a number of assumptions and values about music, about Germanic music, and indeed even the French reaction to Germanic music took into account its significance. Recall again Eric Satie calling upon Claude Debussy and other French composers to come up with a French national music free of any influence of German music. The French composers were looking over their shoulder at the Germans in their efforts to develop a nationalistic style of their own. It had to be non-German. It had to be without sauerkraut. Germany was setting the standard, even for those who were trying to get away from it. Of course, parallel with the First World War were a number of extraordinary developments in Europe and in the Middle East. It could be summarized as follows. Three major political empires collapsed that had been in place for centuries. These were the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which dated from the 16th century, from the Renaissance, as a recognized political organization of Eastern Europe, with Vienna as its capital. That was one of them. The second one to collapse was the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire does not necessarily loom large in our historical consciousness, but you saw from the map last time, the Ottoman Empire represented essentially the political order not only of the Middle East, including what is now Turkey, Israel, Syria, Lebanon, a great portion of what is now Saudi Arabia, but it also embraced southeastern Europe, including the Balkans and Bulgaria and Romania. The third major empire to collapse traced its dynasty back to the early 17th century, and this was the Russian Empire. The Russian Revolution brought about the end of the Romanov dynasty, brought about ultimately the rise of a corrupted form of Marxism, known as communism, and the rise of the Soviet Union. Three major political entities that define Europe, much of Europe, destroyed as a consequence of the First World War, as were other aspects of Western civilization's understanding of itself, as I will shortly show you. The point of this is that since Stravinsky's family, his father and mother, were closely allied with the political establishment of Russia, were closely allied with the Romanov dynasty, Stravinsky's father sang in the Royal Opera Company. There was no place for him in Russia following the Russian Revolution of 1917. And so, having left Russia for Paris, he would remain in Western Europe during the war, in fact, retreating to Switzerland, a politically neutral country. And he would remain there until the threat of the Second World War spoken from Europe to the United States, which became his official residence for the balance of his life, which ended in 1971. In Paris, Stravinsky, like everyone, had to undergo a major readjustment of his artistic aesthetic priorities. He abandoned post-romanticism. He abandoned a nominally Germanic-based style for what comes to be known as neoclassicism. Which, as I indicate here, a post-World War I reaction to post-romanticism. The last several weeks, I've been reading a fascinating study of American art music. It's shortly to come out in paperback. I will recommend it for your summer reading. Classical Music in America, the History of Its Rise and Fall. Joseph Horowitz. I want to read to you three paragraphs from Horowitz's discussion of events that began in 1914. August of 1914 marks the beginning of World War I. Horowitz writes, first of all, to draw attention to his readers to the fact that one of the first casualties in America of World War I and the rising anti-German feeling was the firing of the conductor of the Boston Symphony, who was German. Why? Because he was German. The wave of anti-German feeling that swept Karl Moog off his Boston podium infiltrated lives, public and private, throughout the United States. Only decades previously, the prestige of German learning and art had peaked in America. Germany was the land of Goethe, Kant, Humboldt, Beethoven. With the coming of the Great War, even the teaching and speaking of German came under attack. German Americans were suspected of espionage. They were said by the Red Cross to have sabotaged bandages with ground glass. Overnight, the vigorous subculture of German language newspapers, theaters, singing societies, and schools disappeared. Now there were Germans and Americans only. No hyphenates remained. The Saturday Evening Post urged that the, quote, scum of the melting pot, unquote, be cleaned out of schools, the press, and the government. The peculiar ferocity of the attack on Germans and German Americans had a peculiar cause. In the case of the Revolution and the Civil War, the reasons Americans fought were obvious, and the enemy self-evident. The same would be true of World War II. But reasonable Americans differed over whether to go to war in Europe in 1917 and over which side to join. Americans needed convincing that their adopted cause was just. To this end, a committee on public information, the government's first large-scale attempt to manufacture propaganda, was launched. To stamp out the image of the civilizing German, Kultur was linked with Prussian militarism and the wanton murder of Belgian babies. Quote, in the vicious guttural language of Kultur, Kultur, read one CPI, that is, Committee on Public Information Advertisement, the degree AB means Bachelor of Atrocities. This was the climate in which supposed draft dodgers were forced to kneel and kiss the flag, in which more than 1,500 alleged spies and traitors were arrested and others shot or hanged. This is in America. What's going on involving the Iraq War has precedent. Meanwhile, the first modern cost the lives of 8 million soldiers. It introduced gas warfare, barbed wire, and the machine gun. At the Battle of the Somme, the largest military engagement in recorded history, 11 British divisions arose along a 13-mile front. Put that in perspective. 13 miles is approximately the distance from where Interstate 68 begins at its western end to the Cheat Lake Bridge. 11 British divisions arose along a 13-mile front and began walking forward. Out of 110,000 attackers, 110,000 attackers along that front, 60,000 were killed the first day. How many of you come from communities smaller than 60,000? Morgantown, even with the students present, Morgantown itself is smaller than 60,000. In one day, the entire population of Morgantown killed. No previous war had seemed so impersonal, so illogical, so meaningless, or absurd. World War I discredited the genteel tradition. The genteel scholars and writers were ardent Germanophiles. Many had studied in Germany. It made no difference, or rather it made matters worse, that in most cases they became wartime patriots, supporting Woodrow Wilson's dream of a war to end all wars in a sunburst of moral resolve. The moralism of Gilded Age artists and intellectuals, including their insistence on the moral function of art, remember? Music is supposed to be edifying. Art music lifts the soul. Remember all that? The sacralization of this music? That's the moral function he's talking about, moral resolve. It could not survive the carnage of the war or its destructive diplomatic aftermath. As early as 1915, the New Republic pertinently inquired, quote, "Is it not a possibility that what is today taking place marks as quite as complete a bankruptcy of ideas, systems, society, as did the French Revolution? Americans were left pondering why men had died, as Ezra Pound wrote, for a botched civilization. The plunge of civilization into this abyss of blood and darkness," wrote Henry James, "is a thing that gives away the whole long age during which we have supposed the world to be, with whatever abatement, gradually bettering. Discredited were the politics of romantic nationalism and the aesthetics of grandiose sentiment. The concept of civilization as pursuant to truth and beauty was truly shattered." Everything upon which European art music and its American derivatives have been founded, all of the assumptions, blown away with World War I. And the naivete that surrounded the war is remarkable. My mother, who will be 95 in June, remembers as her first childhood memory the night of November the 11th, 1918. It was, of course, on that day that the armistice was signed and ended the war. And what she remembers is her town, entire community, now a suburb of Chicago, spent the entire night until dawn of the 19th parading around a bonfire in the town square. Why? To celebrate the war that ended all war and made the world safe for democracy. Obviously, no assumptions about art, in the broadest sense, music more particularly, could survive that horror. And indeed, it was a horror. At the time the Americans were about to come into the war in 1917, before they had declared their intention to join Britain and France on the Western Front, the British were developing plans to draft boys down to the age of 13 to serve in the army. Why? Because everybody else was. Yeah. That's how bad it was. Neoclassicism. How to define? Best defined not only as a reaction to post-romanticism, but a reaction of a particular sort. A return to absolute music, coupled with a rejection of the attitude that music can be descriptive. A return to absolute music. It's just about itself. And the rejection of the notion that music can or should be descriptive of anything. Igor Stravinsky's first wholly original neoclassical composition dates from the year 1923. It is his octet, or octuor in French, for winds, of which you have heard the opening movement. Stravinsky, in his first published description of any of his music, had this to say about his octet. Observe its absolute musical qualities as he saw it. My octet is a musical object. The object has a form, and that form is influenced by the musical matter with which it is composed. My octet is not an emotion work. It's not a character piece. It's not a tone poem. It makes no appeal to any narrative or pictorial description of any sort. It is not emotive. It is not subjective. But a musical composition based on objective elements which are sufficient in themselves. This return to absolute music that constitutes neoclassicism invites a closer examination of what is classical about it. And what is classical about this music is the following. First, models were consciously and deliberately taken from 18th century style. Neoclassicism did not have the kind of refined, sophisticated approach to the 18th century that historians have developed since then. Because some of the models for neoclassical style are by Johann Sebastian Bach, Jean-Philippe Rameau, composers we would associate with the Baroque style. But because Rameau and Bach were active in the 18th century, as were Haydn and Mozart, it all got lumped together in the term neoclassical. There is no term neo-Baroque to describe this, even though some of the models are from Baroque musicians. Neoclassical embraces the whole of the 18th century. And we find in the composition the evidence of attention to the neoclassical, or I should say the 18th century models, the 18th century precedents. As we look to the octet, we see the first movement is entitled Sinfonia, the Italian word for symphony. We haven't seen that term as a label for any material in the 19th century. It has a slow introduction and then a fast main portion. Obviously derivative from the slow introduction to sonata form of a Haydn symphony or a Beethoven, early Beethoven symphony. The French overture of Rameau, of course, based on Lully, and so forth. And incidentally, those who are writing on Zwillig, take note. Yes, there is discussion by some of the sources about how her first movement is not typical, but it is surely typical to begin with a slow introduction and have a fast main portion of symphonies dating back to the 18th century. What is atypical, of course, is the fast section of her first movement is not in sonata form. But the temporal relationship, slow to fast, is quite normal. Be sure as you think about revisions to your papers or the final draft, you make that distinction clear. Is that clear for everyone? Now, as we, another characteristic of the neoclassical, at least at its outset, in Stravinsky's repertoire, replaced Stravinsky, is the subordination, if not the outright elimination of the strings. The massive string orchestras that were the core of the post-romantic works of Wagner, Debussy, Mahler, early Schoenberg, they themselves have become emblems of that corrupt and now destroyed civilization. Neoclassicism is defined by winds and brass. It is defined by tonalities that are clearly diatonic, not overwhelmingly chromatic. Though nobody will mistake the tonality of a Stravinsky neoclassical composition with that of a Haydn. But they are clearly tonal. And bear in mind, and I go back to this point again, remember at the same time this is happening, Schoenberg has announced the collapse of tonal harmony. Well, Stravinsky's neoclassical compositions and those of his French allies show that that is false. A third characteristic of the neoclassical style is a very open texture. There are not lots of parts. It's not thick. It's not thin, but it is clear. One can follow it as a sense. Compare, I would suggest, the texture of that excerpt from The Rite of Spring you just heard, which was incredibly thick and with a very large orchestra, with a texture for only 8 inches, distinctive by their respective timbres.
For many European composers, for many
lets in some of the strings, but by no means are we dealing with the full orchestra, the thick string texture of the past. Neoclassicism for the French becomes, of course, neoclassicism for Americans. And one of the most important influences upon the formation of American neoclassical style is Nadia Boulanger, the extraordinary French pedagogue of composition, who for generations taught Western hemispheric students, not just Americans, how to find their own musical style, grounded upon their own musical culture. Copland was her first. Elliot Carter, a later one. Those of you who know the Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla, whose tango-based music has captivated many in recent years, he too was a student of Boulanger. And like Copland, Piazzolla took a Germanic piece to her, and she said to him, "I do not see, or I do not hear Piazzolla in this music. Bring me something of your own." And just as Copland introduced her to jazz-inspired music, Piazzolla introduced her to tango-inspired music. And she said, essentially, "Now we can do business." Boulanger was an extraordinary teacher. She demanded her students master the language of Western art music. Yeah, you had to know harmony, you had to know counterpoint, you had to be able to score reading at the piano. There are basic, non-negotiable skills you had to have. But then, that was to be the foundation of your own personal style of expression. Copland was going to sound like Copland. Not like Boulanger. Carter, like Carter. Piazzolla, like Piazzolla. And so forth, and so on. Ned Warren, like Ned Warren, etc. And that was her extraordinary gift. She argued for neoclassicism in her teaching. A practice that was not nationalistic in character, even though it argued that each composer had to make his or her own choice as to what materials to use, and the best materials were those that were native to that composer's background. Indeed, perhaps one of the best examples of Copland's neoclassicism are those piano variations from 1930. Because they're fairly clean, rigorous, tonal, flirting with serialism by some people's reasons. And fairly hopeful.